The Citizens Energy Alliance's informational flyer says that there have been over 1,000 documented cases of water contamination in the West from drilling. How do we reconcile that with the New York Department of Environmental Conservation's claim that there have been no cases of water contamination from hydraulic fracturing in over 1 million frack jobs?
We were told the same thing in Colorado, that there's no evidence of this. It took citizens' groups like yours to go out and dig. Go to your gas commission. Ask them for their records. They'll probably tell you, well, you'll let you have them, but you'll have to come get them yourself. They won't give them to you. This is what's going on all over the West. People in Utah are going to Salt Lake City to get the information they need. It's the grassroots people from the bottom up where we've been making the best progress. And we're learning more. It's through them that we've been able to get so many of these material safety data sheets. They really don't tell us much, but they tell us something. And so it's so important that you get yourselves organized and have one message. We want, you know, we want monitoring before, we want monitoring during and after, and we want you to be monitoring for what you are using, and this information should be available to the public. You know, you can't buy products on the market, or your even cosmetics, they don't tell you much, the toiletries, but they do tell you what's in those, they're supposed to, a lot of them don't, but they do tell you what's in their products, and they will give them to you in order of which they're in there in the largest concentration. And there's absolutely no reason why these companies can't put on the products. Now, remember, this is another company. You're dealing with the drillers, and the drillers are separate from the frackers, and then they purchase their material from a products manufacturing company, which is usually a company that's already processing natural gas or processing oil. I mean, you know, we say they're cracking crude and refining and making crude into gasoline. These are the kind of companies that are making these products. So you've got to think about what you're dealing with. And each little driller or each company purchases its product from a different salesman. It's the last salesman who got to them, who sold it to them the cheapest, and they'll tell you it's the best. And some are just specialties, some just do proppants, some just do, gelants, crackers, cross-linkers, they all have names. And this is what you're dealing with. It's very difficult to get a handle on it. It's a big business.
Who are the major players behind fracking chemicals and technologies?
That's owned by Halliburton.
Is it only Halliburton?
Yes, I know. That's their patent.
There are technologies being developed to clean up the produced water. How effective are they?
Well, the ones that I know of have been effective to the point where you can use it for agricultural water, but you don't dare drink it. So they're getting it back to the point where they can release it into the environment, but it's not drinking water. Autumn?
Yes.
Maybe you people want to talk about getting organized, get rid of me.
let's take one or two more questions, and then we'll say goodbye, Theo. We really appreciate your time. Hold on.
Okay.
Are there any preliminary studies that have been done on health effects from gas drilling chemicals out there in Colorado or anywhere else that you know of?
Nowhere. Oh, they just did it. They just did a risk analysis, which they can look into, based on, and again, it's all based on the estimations, looking at the frequency and the levels at which they're beginning to measure benzene around Garfield County, and then a risk assessment was done on that. But that's about the nearest I have seen anywhere, and I'm sure if you go into our website, we'll lead you to it. Okay, but no, nowhere. This is something that, you know, it's interesting. Natural gas and the minerals in our country, they're always managed by the government. And the states and have just felt that well, the government is doing this. We don't have to. And so suddenly, and especially in the West, you're not going to find a governor who's going to say, you have to take your mining activity out of my state, when it's very much a part of the revenue that has supported that state for over a century now. So the point is, suddenly, the states are all caught without any really really good rules and regs. And, of course, no one anticipated that they would start using chemicals during drilling. Remember, this is all quite new. This only started about 20 or 30 years ago. It was sand and water, and maybe they used diesel thing. But it wasn't all these super-duper chemicals that improve the flow and that sort of thing.
Theo, my phone is dying.
Okay.
Thank you so much. We've really appreciated your time and all the work you're doing out there in Colorado.
Okay, get yourself organized and join some of those other groups. Bye-bye.
Dr. Theo Colburn, a specialist on the health effects of gas drilling, addressing a community forum in Spencer, New York, via telephone from her home in Colorado, where extensive drilling of the type energy corporations would like to do here in New York is ongoing. She's the co-author of Our Stolen Future, and president of the Endocrine Disruption Exchange at endocrinedisruption.com. There's been conventional gas drilling in this area before, but this is not your grandfather's gas well with a small pipe sticking out of the ground in the far field. These installations are on concrete pads of an acre or more. They can place one of these every 40 acres, and that's what you'll see, instead of lakes, meadows, woods, or cornfields beside old wooden barns. And you'll hear them, not birdsong or frog and cricket symphonies. And you'll smell them as they pollute the air. Gone will be the perfume of honey locusts in bloom, ripening grapes, or damp fallen leaves. This is terrorism of the worst kind, because it's not just one horrible event, but endless. The discussion of the right to know what's in the fracking fluid, as important as that is, bears the implication that gas drilling in the Finger Lakes is a done deal. Not so fast, says Jack Ossent, our next speaker. He's a longtime environmental activist and former county legislator in Yates County. He and his wife, attorney Valerie Gardner, are founders of Democracy New York, an organization devoted to local rights-based organizing, a model pioneered by Tom Lindsay and Richard Grossman at CELDEF, which has been covered extensively on this program. Jack Ossent.
I'm here to tell you that from my perspective, communities should have a right to decide also. And for too long in this country, the state and federal consolidation of authority under the rubric of corporate control has led away from any consideration of individual sovereignty in this country. There's a movement in many parts of the United States today that's called a rights-based organizing, which is centered upon the authority of the community to decide what's best for it. And as my presentation will hopefully show you tonight, it's a progression towards an understanding of how a community might make that choice and what would happen if they did. Now, our organization is Democracy New York. We don't go into communities unless we're invited. I'm not here tonight to tell anybody what to do. I'm only here to offer options to a community that's facing, for many of you, an issue that you might not want to have faced in your community. So I've thrown some quotes up here. I just want to go through a couple of them. Judge Leonard Hand from 1944, I often wonder whether we do not rest our hopes too much upon constitutions, upon laws, and upon courts. These are false hopes. Believe me, these are false hopes. Liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. Down a couple more. They, the FDA, really consider the fish industry to be their clients rather than the U.S. public. Deborah Rice, a former EPA toxicologist. And then someone I'm going to be talking about a little later. If you don't know what your government is doing, you don't live in a democracy, by Jean Ann Morris, who's a cultural anthropologist from the University of Michigan. Now, there's basically three things that a community facing an unwanted proposal or project can do. One, they can do nothing. They can trust in the adequacy of the system to protect their interest, the corporation and the state authority will ensure that that's done. Two, they can challenge the adequacy of the regulatory system's oversight, attempt to improve that oversight by tweaking the regulations. Use what other political expert, witness, legal expertise the community can afford in doing this. Or three, build a majority community view that the proposal or the project should not proceed and support the passage of binding local law. The law can be based upon several concerns, but the policing power of localities under home rule in New York State basically are centered around the protection of health, safety, and the general welfare of the community, including the protection and preservation of the property of the town and its inhabitants. Now, I often think of the regulatory system as sort of a free speech area. Some of you may be familiar with that expression. It's used at political conventions nowadays where you put up crowd control barriers and you take people down into an area where they're allowed to talk about a particular subject, and generally that's far removed from the area of concern with the corporate entities, lobbyists heavily lobbying both the Democrats and the Republicans. It seems like party affiliation in this instance has no concern. Also think of the regulatory system sort of as a funnel. Basically, you have a community facing a complex and broad-based problem. It has several facets to it, environmental, economic, you've got property valuation concerns, you've got health concerns, as we were regaled with in Theo's. Now, generally what happens, and to this date and time, is that we, concerned citizens, along with corporations, lobbyists, attorneys, elected officials, regulatory agencies, drive people down this funnel, down to this environmental endpoint down here at the bottom, where you're only allowed to talk about what the regulatory agency allows you to talk about. Parts per million, how much gets spread, how much gets released under a speedies permit into the water around the area, how much water is going to be drawn from your watershed to be used in the fracking, things of that nature. And up to this point in time, people that are on the other side of this funnel have been pushing people down into the regulatory channel too, concerned citizens, professionals, hunting and wildlife enthusiasts, environmentalists, conservationists, friendly elected officials that are concerned about the issue. They've been saying give up saying no and go into that regulatory funnel and struggle to make the issue of concern more palatable, more acceptable to the community. Now, generally what's happened when a community is facing an unwanted intrusion, they call the attorney. So the attorney is the first one to advise the community generally, and attorneys have to go according to the prevailing rule of law. And an examination with community rights forums, which we'll get to a little bit later, the rule of law has been formed over a period of over 200 years in this country and has eventually served the interests of corporate bodies. And I think we don't have to belabor that fact. Most people today understand the power of the corporation and its ability to mold and influence formation of law. So our perspective is not going into this regulatory channel, because what it removes the community from doing is giving the right to decide to the people who are going to have to live with a problem for the rest of their lives. I would like to read a short section from a handout that's over here on the table, if there's any left, from Jane Ann Morris, and it's a piece called Help, I've Been Colonized and I Can't Get Up, Take a Lawyer and an Expert to a Hearing and Call Me in a Decade. So what do people do while hiding behind the corporate shield? The short version is that they write a script for us and we follow it. Then they write a script for themselves and we don't even read it. And what she's referring to here, and I usually do a show of hands, how many people in this room have read corporation law and are familiar with it? So we don't even know what we're facing, essentially, right? I mean, is that a good summation? A big part of the script written for ourselves, regulatory law, including environmental and administrative law, it assumes that corporations have the right of constitutional persons. It outlines procedures for what we do, what people can do, not much, what governments can do a little more, and what corporations can do a lot. At regulatory agencies, corporate persons, that is, corporations, have constitutional rights to due process and equal protection that human persons, affected citizens, do not have. For non-corporate human citizens, there's a democracy theme park where we can pull levers on voting machines and talk into microphones at hearings. But don't worry, they're not connected to anything, and nobody's listening except us. What regulatory law regulates is citizen input, not corporate behavior. So when we cooperate in regulatory law proceedings, we are following the script that corporations' representatives have written for us. We're either colonized or we're collaborators. That the regulatory agencies fail to protect the public is clear. Why they fail is another matter. And why they fail is essentially what we get into when we get into community rights forums. Now, I wanted to also point out that on that last diagram with the funnel, culture is also driving us into that regulatory funnel. And by culture, I mean the prevailing view that is channeled into media as media presents its view to us. So I just happened to see this the other day. It's from the Times leader down in Pennsylvania, northeastern Pennsylvania, and the headline says, DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, gas concern, drilling not linked. Well, if you saw that and you were just perusing through, you'd say, ah, I knew that was, you know, there's all these environmentalists and all these people that are complaining about the health effects that it's not linked. But then it says in the first paragraph, State Department of Environmental Protection has identified that the natural gas contaminating water wells in Dimmick Township as coming from underground rock formations that are being tapped by gas drillers. I'd say there's a 180-degree difference, wouldn't you, in terms of what the cultural perspective from media. Well, what about this regulatory system? How does the regulatory system work in our culture? I don't think I have to go too far to show you what happened in the SEC, the Security Exchange Commission. This is an article that's just recently come out. Harry Markopoulos, who is this whistleblower that for 10 years has been telling the SEC through three major federal offices in the United States that the fish didn't quite smell good down on Wall Street, and in particular, Mr. Madoff, who made off with $50 billion estimated at this point in the Ponzi scheme, was doing something that should be investigated. Where were the regulators? You know that I'm bringing this up for a reason. This is the political cartoonist having a field day at Mr. Madoff's expense and also at the expense, I'm afraid, of another financial system which is being faced right now with the accusation that it too might be a Ponzi scheme of some sort that has never been investigated, which is the U.S. financial system and specifically the Federal Reserve. This is the Agriculture Department and the people that FDA who look over our food Second paragraph says, the order which affects Peanut Corporation of America and its subsidiary will remain in force for 1 year. In other words, they've slapped the Peanut Corporation of America with a one-year penalty here. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack also stripped the company's chief executive of his seat on a board that advises the government on peanut quality standards. That's your regulatory system at work. One that really shocked me, and I've been shocked many times, this comes from an oversight, OMB, Office of Management and Budget, in 2007, Matthew Madia wrote this. Federal Drug, Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act requires FDA to ensure the safety of new drugs before the agency approves the drugs for market. However, operating within a provision of the law, legal, FDA also approves drugs before safety is established. The agency then requires drug manufacturers to further study drugs while they are on the market. These post-market commitments serve to streamline the drug approval process. FDA recently revealed that many of the post-marketing commitments go unfulfilled. On February 2nd, the agency published a report in the Federal Register detailing the progress of post-marketing commitments, which in fiscal year 2006 numbered 1,259 drugs out there. As the new standard reported, FDA said drug companies, quote, had yet to initiate 71% of outstanding post-market safety evaluations. Meanwhile, only 11% have been submitted. These drugs remain on the market, yet neither FDA nor drug makers have proved their safety. I want you to keep in mind, while I'm going through this litany of examples of regulatory behavior, how are we going to be assured on what's happening in the gas drilling that's going to come into this area? Now, I happen to know the woman that wrote these comments and worked with her for several years, Ellen Harrison, who was the head of the Waste Management Institute at Cornell University, on the spreading of sewage sludge. And there was a report that came up from the National Research Council that reported to the EPA that there were several inadequacies in how they were looking at sludge being applied on farmlands on which our food was being raised. And down here, number one, human health, failure to commit to studies of health at sites where people reporting illness, failure to commit to health surveillance at land application sites. Are we going to be assured that when we have reports of health impacts around gas drilling, that anybody's going to come? Two, failure to recognize the serious limitations of the NSS regarding limits of, that's a quality for a requirement for detection, so that when failure to detect is used to eliminate chemicals from consideration, chemicals may be eliminated due to the flawed survey rather than due to absence of the chemicals in the sludges. What she's saying there is that they weren't testing for a broad enough range of chemicals that were in the sludge. So when it was assured that the sludge was all right, people didn't have any knowledge of the other chemicals that were never tested for. I've been interested in where in did hydrofracking and gas production get exempt in the Clean or Safe Drinking Water Act and Water Pollution Control Act. I spent 2 hours on doing research on the net before I could get to the Energy Policy Act of 2005 and find this section. But when our representatives were reading that bill, this is all they saw. And what essentially they did is these attorneys and these people that inserted in the oil and gas industry, they took this exclusion, this paragraph of excluding down here the underground injection of fluids or propping agents other pursuant to hydraulic fracking operations related to oil, gas, or geothermal production activities. And that definition goes into the Public Health Service Act, which is a huge act. They hit it down here in Part C. I found 300H, and down here in D, it refers to underground injection defined. Underground injection endangerment of drinking water sources would not be covered. It's a definitional exemption. And it's even clearer when we come to the next section under the Clean Water Act. This is the text at the top from the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and it says oil and gas exploration. Can everybody read that? It says oil and gas exploration and production. The term oil and gas exploration, production, processing, or treatment operations or transmission facilities means all field activities or operations associated with the exploration, production, processing, treatment operations, or transmission facilities, including activities necessary to prepare a site for drilling and for the movement and placement of drilling equipment, whether or not such field activities or operations may be considered to be construction activities. Essentially, a complete exemption under a definition of what a pollutant is. But up here in the first part, it says the term pollutant means all of these other things. This term does not mean, in other words, pollutant does not mean B, water, gas, or other material which is injected into a well to facilitate production of oil or gas or water derived in association with oil or gas production and disposal of in a well. If the well used either to facilitate production or for disposal purposes is approved by authority of the site in which the well is located, I want you to remember that. If it's approved by the authority of the state in which the well is located, and if such state determines that such injection or disposal will not result in the degradation of ground or surface water resources. That's a federal law saying that if people in that state have enough political juice to take it to the State House of New York, in our case, and convince the state of New York that in this process, huge amounts of water, by the way, I did a calculation. They said that there's going to be over 10,000 wells upstate. I think that's an understatement. If the average, and I talked to a mechanical engineer over here in Van Etten, the last place I spoke, and he told me that probably it's going to be about 3.8 million gallons per frack. And some of the fracking that's done within a five-year period goes beyond the 10 that Theo said, as high as 17. We're talking about a volumetric quantity of water, which is more than half of the Finger Lakes. Finger Lakes are estimated to contain 9 trillion gallons. Where's this water going to come from? And not only where is this water going to come from, what is that water going to look like when it's exposed to all of these chemicals that we don't even know the consistency of? Not only do we not know the consistency of those chemicals, we don't know the synergistic relationships of those chemicals to each other. It's an unknown mass of chemicals that's been created for our consumption, just like those drugs that are out there that we don't know the safety of. We're all guinea pigs in a big way. What happened under the last administration, a lot of things happened under that administration, as we all know, but one of the things that happened is that they increased the amount of toxics by 10 times that can be released into a community. The problem is that the Community Right to Know Act was also one of those acts that was removed from our ability to penetrate under the deal that was inked with the Energy Policy Act of 2005. So now we don't even know the volumes of the chemicals that are going into our waters. Now, Cuomo is suing along with 11 other states to reverse that, but it's too early to know when and if that's going to impact what we're seeing before us now. I don't know how many people in the room have read this book. This was written a couple years ago by Seymour Lachman. It demonstrated that in New York, there are three people who decide the bills that are going to be passed in the state houses: the majority leader in the Senate, the Speaker of the Assembly, and the governor of the state of New York. Those three decide which bills are going to pass. We've got three men that are representing the interest of tens of millions of people in New York State. Now, if you want to read more on that, this is the second edition of the Brennan Center Report for New York State Legislative Reform. The original one, I think, was done in 2006. This is a 2008 update. And in the 2008 update, a couple salient facts I wanted to introduce you to. How many of you folks in here get all those nice flashy brochures that get sent out to you either by your assemblyman or your state senator saying, I introduced this bill and that bill and I'm protecting you and I put all these bills in for senior rights, etc.? Well, the one thing they don't really talk about is how many of those bills got passed. Well, the Brennan Center went into it. In 2006, the number of bills introduced, 17,700, jumped 17.7% in 1 year. In 2008, 18,239 bills were introduced, yet only 1,634 passed both houses. That's slightly better than the 8.2% of bills passed in 2005 and represents a 20.1% increase in the number of bills introduced over just 3 years. Put the figures in perspective, however. According to 2006 statistics, the state with the second highest number of bills introduced was New Jersey. I never thought New York was going to outstrip New Jersey, but this is an area in which that we claim number one. California's legislature, representing nearly twice the population of New York, introduced fewer than 2,000 bills. Of those bills, talking about floor debate, 2006, 97.4 of major bills passed the Senate and 6.5 of major bills passed the Assembly without substantive debate. 89.5 of major bills passed the Senate and 86.3 of major bills passed the Assembly without any discussion at all. This is our legislature. These are the people that we send to discuss our business in a supposedly constitutional and democratic society. We haven't been demanding very much of our Assembly and our Senate, I would submit to you, to show results like this. I'm going to skip now to what happens in the state of New York. We did the federal regulatory thing. This is the state regulatory thing. This was just recently sent out in an email by someone who's connected to and interested in what we're talking about. A recent DEC report indicates that they think it's safe to use brine from gas wells on roads. An investigation of naturally occurring radioactive material in oil and gas wells in New York State's executive summary. That's what it comes from. I don't find the DEC report comforting. The research samples on which the report is based did not include Marcellus Shale, and they were mainly taken in western counties in New York, not the southern tier, where many Marcellus Shale wells will be drilled. Does this remind anybody of anything in terms of responding to areas and basing the current research on the area in which you're going to have to expect some report in either health or some other related concern? This is the state of New York. Now, where does this come from? Where is it that the state of New York can decide to use brine on a road? Well, on the DEC website, and this is public knowledge, how many people have ever heard of beneficial use determinations? Beneficial use determinations are no other thing than a euphemism for taking the effluent from industry, legitimizing its use in another way so it minimizes the cost of an externality. An externality is a fancy word for saying something that industry would have had to pay for if they'd gotten rid of it in a responsible manner. Now, let me demonstrate a couple of things here. Not every one of these is as bad as what I'm going to point out. But if you go through this list, this is categorized in accordance with its waste type and what the uses are. We've got dredged material up here. Now, anybody that has any familiarity with water and dredging, and especially out of the canal system, knows that industry that was located along that canal system in New York State deposited heavy loads of PVCs and other volatile organic chemicals. Thank you. It's been a long week. Down here in dust, we've got baghouse dust coming out of Refill Corp up in Buffalo. A baghouse dust comes out of a filtration system that's set up to control pollution that is released into the air. So like industry does in almost every instance that I've been involved in environmentally, is they play a shell game. They take it out of the air, but the question is, where do they put it then? Are they responsible once they've got it out of the air? You applaud the fact that they got it out of the air, but where does it go now? Well, in this instance, it goes into flowable fill. Now, anybody have any idea what flowable fill is? You ever see these guys on the road with their diamond studded saws? Right. In that concrete, in that asphalt, is a repository of a huge number of these waste products. And how many people do you see using the masks, I mean, just individually for safety, out there in that dust storm that they create? Not to mention the fact that cars are driving down through this dust and inhaling it themselves. But beneficial use determinations. Go to the DEC website and you will see page after page, including things that are spread on farmland, things that go into aggregates, things that go into topsoil, a liming agent out of the cement kiln. The liming agent gets combined, and there's lots of heavy metal out of cement kiln dust production. A lot of heavy metal production that exceeds the EPA quality, but they get away with using it as a liming agent. Anybody that's familiar with Enviro soils, they mix this in with sludge coming out of Syracuse, and it comes out into our area and is spread on farmlands. It's a cheap liming agent, even though some farmers actually pay to put that on their farms. Now, how about these corporations? These are the top 50 corporations in the United States in terms, they made this top list by not paying their taxes. 7 out of the top 49 are energy producers. And number 2 on the list is that energy producer coming into some of our areas, including where I live, Chesapeake Energy. And you also see CMS Energy at the top, dealing with utilities. You see Allegheny Energy down here. And if you go down through the list, there's several other Xcel, et cetera, et cetera. These folks are so responsible that they've been effective in paying very little of their taxes to maintain American society. I think most of us knew that. Now, this comes from the Cyclopedia Law Dictionary, and I just wanted to point out to you why we have such trouble understanding what this dictionary defines as private law. Private law is one which relates to private matters which do not concern the public at large. And guess what law that is? Corporate law. Now, that's the definition under which they go by. That's the law that we don't read, but every day affects our employment, our rights. When you cross I just recently saw workers that had crossed a corporate property line, and they'd suffered some health problems on the other side. And the people that, in fact, it was the Peanut Corporation of America. Maybe you saw this clip on the internet. The sheriff went down there, or an investigator went down there to talk to them. And he said, "You wait out there, or we'll call the sheriff because you're crossed our line." You know, there was no way that anyone could come across that corporate property line that wasn't allowed to be there, even though their actions had created a public menace. Now, the public law is one which affects the public either generally or in some cases. That's the distinction. What we have up at the top is this geographical place. For example, you in this community facing what you're facing. What the Democracy School folks preach is called right-based organizing, and what we also, having been trained there, also agree to is right-based organizing and place-based organizing. And instead of going down the chute with the regulatory agencies and the affected corporations and the culture, we go the other way in coming into a community that's requested to hear this message and assist the people within that community to construct binding law which deals with a broader root issue. This issue is not just about gas drilling. It's not just about health of the chemicals that are in this water or the nature of the chemicals that are in this water. It's a question of who gets to decide. Is it the directors of a corporation that are coming in and extracting gas, and that's estimated, and you've seen these flashy advertisements on television, I'm sure by mobile that's running, that 50 million homes for the next 10 years, what they fail to tell you is that the real estimate is it's 2 to 3 years worth of gas. Because there's 160 million households in the United States, according to the last census. So you do the math. I think it comes out to 3.2 years. They also fail to tell you is that the extraction process in itself is highly speculative. They're saying there might be that much, but when you start taking the gas out, some gas rapidly deplete, have to be refracted, they aren't successful, and the last pieces of that gas to come out are much more difficult to extract, much more costly to extract. So as it progresses, some of these wells are abandoned, or they don't produce nearly as much as they originally estimated on first production. So it's a question not only of who gets to decide. Does that corporate body get to decide? Or does the community that's going to be affected for a much longer term than the extraction of a raw resource of which they're going to maximize their profits, which is the bottom line of any corporation, is to maximize their profits and minimize yours. But it's also a question of how long do we have to deal with this, and how long do they have to deal with it? How many of those corporate directors live in the township of Spencer? How many of those directors live in the township of Van Etten? How many of you are going to have to deal with this? How many of you live in those townships? Remember that there was a section in the law, the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which stipulated that states can make a decision as to whether or not this is going to degrade the water to an extent that it shouldn't be done. This comes from one of the groups down here in the Delaware that opposes the drilling legislation or agency regulations. It provides separate and unequal environmental protection for different people or different counties or different watersheds within New York State. A gas extraction industry process that is considered too environmentally unsafe to be used in a particular watershed, for example, New York City's, is not safe for use in any other watershed and therefore should not be permitted for use anywhere in this state. Now, there's a couple things in there that particularly struck me. You know, it's like this separate but unequal kind of situation where citizens in a state are supposed to be equally protected. Remember what happened on the racial divide where we had separate but unequal protections. It's called discrimination. Now, New York City, the reason New York City, and perhaps many of you know this, is protesting so strenuously down there, not to mention the things that we've heard tonight, but also there's money involved. It's estimated it's going to cost New York City between $5 and $15 billion to build a filtration plant if the quality of their water is degraded by this permitted business use. So they've got an incentive. Now I ask you, the question was raised by Theo, how many of you have private wells? Almost all of us do, right? I mean, I have one where I live. Now, is industry come in here and said that they're going to build a closed-loop system that's going to guarantee that we're going to have water in the future? That guarantees that kind of coverage for all of your neighbors and not just some that can afford to go away from here if they get a high enough gas contract and decide not to live in this community? I mean, there's a strategy of involvement here by the corporations. They not only divide us on economic interest because some of you get gas leases and some of you don't, but they also divide you on the basis of your understanding of what's at stake. I hate to break the news to you, but we live in a corporate state. And the reason I say that is that under contract law in the Constitution, what exists as a contract between a private corporation, which is chartered by the state, even though they'll tell you it's not a state actor under the 14th Amendment when it comes to state actors discrimination, is a contract. There is no contract between the state legislature and a public corporate charter, municipal corporation. There's no contract at all. The state does not recognize that as being a contract. In other words, the people are non-self-governing. You may have all the bells and whistles. You may have the democracy theme park. You may elect these local representatives, but their authority, as far as the state is concerned, is preempted at almost every turn by one or another administrative law, agency regulation, or public law. Now, what does that mean in a democracy when people realize that this is actually the case that we live under? We're actually serfs on the land to a certain extent. Now, what happens when you make binding law? I'm not here to tell you that you won't be challenged, but I do want to give you a couple examples tonight of where people have had the courage to say that we're not allowing this corporation to come in this case in Barnstead. This is 2006 up here. I neglected to put this is 2 years later in an adjacent township, Nottingham. In 2006, the township of Barnstead, New Hampshire, voted in their town form of government. And I think there was one dissenting vote of all the people that attended that meeting. There was over 200 or 300 people there. That they would not allow water extraction corporations to come in and take their water and bottle it. They also said that in their township, a corporation would not be recognized as a person under the law. That's where corporations get their authority. Corporations are considered to be legal persons under the law. And they have all of our civil rights. They're super citizens, if you will. Now, 2 years later, as of this time, not one water has been extracted from Barnstead Township, even though it sits on some beautiful potable water. Nottingham, at that point in time, along with Barrington, which is another township in close proximity to the two, was going down the regulatory chute. And Nottingham was hiring attorneys and expert witnesses, and they were going to regulatory hearings and spending, I can't remember the total, but I know it was tens of thousands of dollars that the citizens within that township expended. And the state said, no, we're going to allow that corporation to come in. When they decided 2 years later to do the same thing that Barnstead had done and passed a law not only recognizing that a corporation was not a citizen, but upping the ante a little bit more and recognizing the rights of nature. Now, the rights of nature is a concept that's under wild law, and I'm not going to go into it at depth tonight. But what it does is it gives people within a community a way to take nature into court and say, my stream has been damaged by this corporate body, and I'm going to step into that stream, and that stream has standing in court because it's been injured. It's a pretty radical concept. But if we're sincere about protecting our environments against these kind of corporate assaults, don't you think it's about time that we started considering that too? In New Jersey, one of the things that New Jersey has done very well, Lyndhurst, an old industrial town with 20,000 meadows in the meadowlands of northern New Jersey, is the only second municipality in the United States to adopt the precautionary principle as an overarching guide to municipal policy and the first on the East Coast. The ordinance was introduced on October 14th in 2008 and passed by a unanimous vote of the Township Commission. The ordinance reads the following: precautionary principle shall be established as the policy of the Township of Lyndhurst. When an activity raises threats of harm to human health or the environment, precautionary measures should be taken even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully established scientifically. What that essentially means is, if you can't prove it's safe to me, you ain't doing it. What that means is, in that prior thing where diagram where I showed you where the corporation had equal standing with the state, that those corporate lobbyists have gone into some of our elected legislators and said, listen, if you demand that those proprietary chemicals be released to the state, we're going to sue the state under our Fifth Amendment rights, and that would constitute a taking of our property, which we're protected under the Constitution from having happen. You ever wonder why so many of the decisions that are made at local levels, the people come out of a meeting and say, you know, we had no other choice. We can't do anything else. The law says that we're going to have to proceed in this manner. Those are very often examples of where there's been a private meeting between the corporate attorney and that town has passed something that steps on a property of the corporate body, and they've had that private decision. You don't learn about this because how many times has anybody, to your knowledge, talked about corporate personhood in major media or any other media that you know of? That's the root problem. That's what all of this goes back to. By the way, I was a county legislator over in Yates County, and I've been exposed to some of this from which I speak.
A question from the audience. It seems like there's only a small minority of us that are concerned and frightened and want to know all the information. There are people I've known for a long time, good people, who are normally concerned about the environment and who love their land, that seem not to want to know because they think they're going to make a lot of money. It makes me feel rather hopeless.
There are people who I can understand feel the way they do about this money because a lot of small farmers out there are struggling. Agribusiness has decimated these large, another segment of the corporate state has decimated small family farms. I grew up on a dairy farm. I can remember when all the farms down the road I lived on were dairy farms, and they were owned by families. In a moronic twist to a certain extent, I still live on that in that area, and all of those farms are dairy farms because the Mennonites have moved in. But in other towns and other areas, that has not been the case, and we've lost tremendous amounts of farmers. So I can understand that the money in holding on to the land and holding on to the farm, that becomes an overriding personal interest to be supportive of this. And we've lost a lot of our concept of community. And that, I think, is another basic problem that has given these corporations the ability to penetrate us so easily, is that we don't have that sense of cohesiveness and cultural closeness that we used to have. So what I always advise the minority in a community is that the hardest work in making this work is to build that majority by reaching out and doing the hard work. Now, it may not work here. And quite frankly, I don't want to spend my energy in a community that can't build that majority. Because there, hopefully, and I'm not sure that on this issue it's going to work, because they have been as successful as they have been in marginalizing people from each other with competing interests. But I personally think that the overall writing factor here is it worth 2.5 years to 3.2 years of gas in this country to pollute the most valuable natural resource that we have in this entire region? And are the economic costs that are involved in that pollution, tourism, agriculture, the health costs that are going to evolve from the people's exposure to this contaminated water. Margaret Mead said that the only thing that has ever created change was a small number of people, a minority, that was convinced, stubborn enough, committed enough, didn't know when to quit, that convinced enough people that this was a bad idea. I don't know of any other way of giving you hope, because I think that she's accurate in that. And when they teach the schools that I went through, when they trained us, they talked about this is the most difficult part of dealing within a community is to get the majority. You saw the Energy Policy Act of 2005. It says if there is enough political juice in this state to force the state to recognize that there's a threat to the water, it should be covered under the Safe Water Drinking Act and the Water Pollution Act, which means that the state, our state, has the authority to stop this if there's enough political pressure, enough public pressure.
Their own thesis.
You know there's going to be a battle, because under the current law, this is a permitted business use. And once you announce a permitted business use, the corporation has a vested interest in protecting its property. That doesn't mean that it can't be rescinded, however, under a violation of existing law. And that law has existed. That law exists now. So if the state of New York receives enough resistance under this degradation, and I think there's two issues here. There's the degradation of water, but also there's the health question. And I think as Theo discussed with us earlier, both of those issues could be used to build public pressure on our elected officials.
Jack Ossent of Democracy New York, an organization that assists communities in fighting corporate assaults through rights-based organizing and the passage of binding local law. To find out how to get involved to stop gas drilling, visit shaleshock.org. That's shaleshock.org. You can download an MP3 of this program, which I encourage you to pass along to your friends and neighbors, at our website, unwelcomeguests.org, where all previous programs are also available. Thank you for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.